Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week, Lisa Call from New Zealand. Lisa, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Looking forward to learning about your art. Now, for our listeners, technically it's quilting, but it isn't normal quilting by any stretch.
Normal. What's normal?
Yeah, I don't know, but it's textile art is what it is to me. It's not quilting. It's just some fascinating work. So let's just start at the beginning. Obviously, a creative family, an environment that allows you to just stretch your mind.
Yeah, I'm really thankful to my parents for allowing us to experience creativity and getting to try new things. And I just remember them being very supportive of us making things and encouraging us. And they both were makers themselves.
Yeah. And well, even back to your grandmothers, I mean, it says in my readings that they were quilters. So you had the full gamut.
They were, you know, I don't have a lot of memories of my grandmothers making things. They were, you know, they were in Kansas living on a farm. They were working on the farm. But when my grandmother got older, she made dolls. She was making dolls well into her late 90s.
Hmm. So that's perfect for you then, huh?
Yeah, they were pretty fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. And what the story of kids in a basement with craft supplies and just do whatever?
Yeah. So, you know, I thought kids should get the space to do whatever they want. So I had this unfinished basement, and they had all their craft supplies, and they could do whatever they wanted to down there. And mostly it was make a huge mess. One of their favorite activities, they would put paint on popsicle sticks and throw it at the wall to make designs. They invented a Jackson Pollock's work all on their own. I suspect, you know, the floor in there was covered in paint. The walls were covered in paint. When people bought that house, they probably wondered what was going on down there. I'm like, you know, they just were having a lot of fun. And we'd have to go dig it out. And, you know, once it became a huge mess, they wouldn't go down there much. So we'd have to dig it out and let them start over again, making a mess.
their own graffiti wall. Just go nuts.
Yeah. And they're both very creative today. Both doing creative work, which is great to see that they stayed connected to that side of creativity.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the environment. It really allows you to ask that question, what if, and what if I put paint on a popsicle stick and throw it, what happens? Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Mostly they were probably wondering, am I going to get in trouble?
Well, yeah, there is that little thing on your shoulder. Yeah, when's it going to come down on me? Yeah.
Let's keep doing it, because why not? We're kids.
Yep. So you originally from the States in Denver, and then you moved to New Zealand. What drives you? I mean, that doesn't happen every day.
No, it doesn't happen every day. I was working full time as a software engineer, and at the same time, I was working on getting my own art career off the ground. And at first, I was just making work I wanted to make because I just wanted to be the best artist I possibly could be. But eventually I realized I don't really want to keep working. I was working for a large soulless corporation managing a software team, and that no longer was fun. So I started selling my work, and I started teaching, because I always loved teaching. Way back in my getting a software engineering degree, getting a computer science degree, I got kind of sidetracked being a TA and teaching classes, so I always loved it. So when I thought about how do I make money other than working for tech, I decided I wanted to start teaching. And one of the first in-person jobs I received an offer was to teach in Australia and New Zealand. And I realized, well, if I'm going to Australia and New Zealand and I've got this job, they're not going to let me stay there for a couple months like I want to. So I figured out, I quit my job, and then came out to Australia and New Zealand to teach. And then I never went home because it was really great. And I met a guy, and you know how that story goes. And so here I am in New Zealand 8 years later. I'm a citizen of New Zealand now.
That works. That works fine. Well, the art, when you're doing the computing job, is the art your escape? I mean, art is always there, it sounds like.
Art is always there. And looking back, I keep a studio log, and I have forever, you know, 30 years I've kept a studio log. How many hours did I spend in my studio that day, and what was I working on? And I got more studio time in when I had a job as a software engineer than being self-employed teaching. Because as when you're self-employed, you feel more responsibility. You know, when you're working at a software company, you know, 9 to 5, I'm done.
Yeah.
This was pre-thinking they could call you on the phone at night and you were always working. I wouldn't survive in today's work world very well. I'm not much to being on call like that. Nope. No, thank you. So software to me was just a day job. I didn't really identify strongly with computer science. While I think it's fun, it was never my identity. I've always really more identified as an artist.
So it paid the bills and bought you art supplies then?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Tech pays well. It's a trap, right? You get paid well at tech, and art does not pay well. So
right.
I did it for many years.
Yeah. Yeah. So while you're doing the work, I mean, are you in a mental situation while you're doing the work, you know, watching the clock till 5 o'clock to get home to do the art? Is a constant pull on you?
No, I'll have to say that, I'm really good at my job in the computer science world, and it never took me 40 hours a week to do it. And I worked at home a lot, so some of that time I might have been in my studio. Computer science is, I went into computer science because it was easy, not really, and it was kind of fun, but I'm fast. I'm fast at making art too, so I'm just, I do things quickly.
Yeah. Well, and that world offers you some flexibility in that if you're in a job situation you don't care for, you can generally move on quite easily. So,
And software, you know, when you're working for a software company, at least, if you pick and choose the right ones, there's a lot of flexibility in that job. A huge amount of flexibility, time flexibility there. You know, if you have to have a corporate job, I can't think of too many that are going to be easier to deal with.
Yeah. No, I'm a magazine editor, and I've worked at home for a long time, way before the pandemic. And no, I know that that environment quite well, where you, there's some days where you got to put in the hours, and then there's other days where, not so much. I'll do a little needlework on the side, or in this case, record podcasts or any number of things. Yeah. Yeah. It makes it better all the way around. So then you moved to New Zealand and, a teaching opportunity, but that's really sticking your neck out to just move that far away
Yeah, it's an adventure. I'm a big fan of adventure. Being open to whatever might possibly happen. Life is here to be experienced, and the only way to do that is to pay attention to when opportunities come your way, and then take advantage of those opportunities.
Are you still teaching for that group?
That was just one time.
Oh,
it was just a 1 week. Sort of workshop, 1 week in Australia and 1 week in New Zealand. So my teaching is almost all online, kind of built my own following. It started way back in the early 2000s with blogging. And, you know, I was a big blogger. I was one of those bloggers that used to blog every day. And I, thousands of blog posts that I one day purposely deleted. That was stupid. I would love to have them to reappear magically, but you know, that's a lot of work to make that happen. So I, you know, and I would exhibit my work in the art quilt world. And so I teach online through my own website.
Yeah. Yeah, that that blogging thing, there's very few people who still blog every day, very few who do it every day, and not many more who do it on a regular basis. Boy, that's hard to keep up.
You know, my dream and my thought is to still blog as often. I have a lot of things I'd like to say, but there's one as I'm really just kind of stretch a little thin, because it's a choice of do I blog or do I actually go make art? And so the art will win in that situation. So I don't give it as much time as I used to. I don't make as much time for it. I'm pushing the art a little bit more. But the other thing is that most people don't blog that much. And I'm like, well, everyone unsubscribe to my blog if I write more. And I need to get that idea out of my head, because I don't really care, right? I mostly do it for myself. I think blogging is one of the greatest tools for understanding my own art. And, you know, it doesn't work the same way as if you're writing privately. Because when you're writing publicly, you have to make sense. You have to form complete sentences, and you need to have a structure to it. And I sit down and think I'm going to be writing about one thing, and in the end, I'm writing about something completely different. Yeah. I do not necessarily have clarity on what I think about something until I sit down and try and put it into words that I can communicate with the world. And so I have a list of all the things I'd like to blog about, and then I think, oh, that's old news. And so then I don't. So I've managed to kind of like claw my way back to once a month. And, you know, my dream is at least once a week. It's an invaluable process. I think you can't say enough about how important blogging was, one, to creating my career, and two, just learning more about myself.
Yeah. Well, I read a bunch of your pieces, and many times I could see you in your writing, just working things out. And it's fascinating. It's fun to read, because I learned right along, you know, with you and how you just sorted things out with your writing. It was it's quite interesting.
Yeah, it's a really great process. I love it. Yeah. I always get, you know, I talk about it and then I get like, oh, I'm gonna blog more, but I don't. And, I mean, here's the reality is that blogging is creating written content. And so I'm writing, and I don't use AI to do any of that. I have plenty of things in my own head to write. I do not need, I don't need AI to help me do this. But I run this online community for artists, and I generate a huge amount of content for that. I'm always writing for that. I'm doing a lot of writing for my students. So I am doing as much writing as I used to on my blog, but a lot more of it now is locked behind this paywall. Mm-hmm. And that's really what it comes down to, is that I now get paid to do some of that writing. And so I will never, I mean, as much as I think it would be really cool to blog more because it's so important, I will never do as much public blogging, because I am doing a lot of writing. It's not like I quit writing. I'm still doing as much. It's just that you won't see it if you're not a member of the Make Big Art community or taking one of my classes.
Right, right. Yeah, but I know that process. I mean, I have to write an editorial for every magazine issue, one of the things I truly hate, and because you got to sound intelligent and informed, and that's, you know, that's hard to do in 500 words. And many times I've sat down with nothing to say, and my process is just start throwing words down and random thoughts, and pretty soon something gels, and then you just go. Yeah,
you know, and I think that's the kind of the way making art works a lot of the times too. Just show up and start doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how does your art evolve? What did you start out doing quilting, or how do you get to this point?
Did. So here's the brief history of my art career. I always kind of sewed things. Like the thing that I remember most is we had this cabin up in the mountains in New Mexico, and we would go up there and we had a clubhouse. I asked my sister about this. I'm like, how did I end up the president of a clubhouse? It was just my siblings and I. There were three of us. I was the middle child. And she said, I'm pretty sure you just decided. I'm like, yeah, that sounds like me. but I'm like, you know, we never really had meetings. We just rearranged wood, you know, in our clubhouse, which was just stacked up wood. And I sewed this pocket full of pockets. I just took a bunch of fabric and sewed a bunch of pockets so I could put things in it, probably sticks for all I know. But I always liked sewing. And then when I was 17 years old, a friend of mine told me she was going to make a quilt, or she was making a quilt. And I thought, well, I could do that. I'm like, that sounds like fun. And so I found some fabric, and it was scraps from old blue jeans and curtains and who knows what fabric was just, you know, hanging around our house, kind of left over from things. And I had absolutely no idea how to make a quilt. My mom had sewn a lot of clothes, and so I'd seen her sew. And when I was in home ec in 8th grade, they tried to get us to do sewing, and I think I sewed the skirt, and then I said, I'm not doing this. And I remember doodle art, where you had those posters, you had markers, and you filled things in. That's what I did during the sewing part of home ec. I'm like, I'm not sewing, I refuse. My best friend and I would sit there and color. We were basically coloring with markers, and everyone else was sewing something. We're like, we're not going to do that. We don't want to do that. We have zero interest in it. So I knew a 5/8 inch seam, so that's what I did, is I randomly cut out some squares and I sewed them together with a 5/8 inch seam. And then I thought, well, now what? And I remember going out to our garage, because we had a whole bunch of old blankets and quilts that we would throw over the ice cream maker when we were making it, trying to find one that was an actual quilt to figure out how you finished it. How did you put these layers together? And there were no actual quilts. They were all just big blankets. So I thought, here's how you do it. You sew the top to the batting. And I did that. And I didn't put a backing on it. I don't know what I was doing. So that whole, I eventually did put a sheet on the back side of it, because I didn't know where you got big fabric otherwise. And I used that quilt forever. And so that was my start as a quilt maker. And for, you know, the next 10, 11 years while I was going through graduate school and undergrad, I would make about one quilt a year, and I knew nothing. I didn't have any idea that there was like this community of quilters out there. And I cut out templates from the back of a cereal box, because I did get my hands on a quilting book. I think my mom gave me this traditional quilting book. So I'm cutting out templates out of cardboard, and I'm hand drawing the lines on the fabric and cutting it with scissors. And I did that for about 11 years, you know, making these traditional quilts with cardboard templates. And I graduated from graduate school. I went off to New York. We moved to New York, and one of the first things I did is I went into a quilt shop. I had never been in a quilt shop, and I was amazed. And they had these things called rotary cutters. I'm like, whoa, this is pretty brilliant. You can like cut your fabric with a pizza cutter instead of with scissors. And so I took a class, and then I joined a quilt guild, and I discovered this whole world. And this was this would have been in around 1990. I discovered this entire world of quilters, and very quickly from there, it totally took off. Like within 3 years, I had moved from traditional quilting to art quilting. I had connected with quilters on the internet back in 1990, where there were no pictures, but we would do block exchanges. And so I made a bunch of quilts from quilt blocks that came from all over the world. We had this big exchange with a Russian quilter, which was, you know, back in the early 90s was unheard of. So we sent her a whole bunch of things, and she sent us stuff, and it was an amazing time, and it was really fun. But I found, you know, working with patterns, I'm not much for following rules, and I wanted to do my own thing. So in 1993, I made my first what I would call art quilt, using my own design, doing my own thing. It was eventually published in Art Quilt Magazine, which is no longer around, but it was kind of the first of the art quilt magazine sorts out there. And from there, it kind of took off in the early 90s through the late 90s. I was just sort of doing my own thing, entering a bunch of shows, museum shows, and lots of multimedia shows, and winning awards, but also entering the traditional quilt shows, still doing a little bit of that in there. And then in 1999, I took a class with Nancy Crowe. I learned how to do improv piecing, and that was it. That switched my work to doing improvisational piecing, and I haven't really done much other than that since. I don't do what, you know, just that. I mean, you said, you know, it's quilting like no other, because I do a lot of quilting on my work, a huge amount of quilting. It's maybe thread painting. I don't know. I don't know what it's called. Right. The other day someone says, oh, you do really nice matchstick quilting. I'm like, what is that? So I'm like, I got to go research this term. I don't know what this means.
I've not heard that one. Matchstick quilting. Okay.
Matchstick quilting. And I think it just means sewing really straight lines close together. But I kind of view it as across the whole surface of the quilt and not really taking the composition of the quilt into consideration. It's really more like, I just want to hold this thing together, and someone said I had to quilt it, so I will. Where I want my stitching to be another layer on top of the work. And the way I kind of view it is, painters do color washes. So they'll like really thin down their paint, either their oil paints or their acrylics or even watercolor, really, really thin. So it's just a really light layer of color. And they will do layer after layer after layer of color with the paint. And so it's like layering that on. And that's what I see with the thread, is that I'll do layers of thread over the top of each other in different colors to do that same sort of color washing that you can do with paint. And so that's where that's how I view the stitching part of it. And it takes forever, and it's, you know, meditative to be sewing with my sewing machine forever and ever.
Well, that's, yeah, and for me, visually, that's what defines your work, is all those lines, one after another, they just make it all come together, because the, And I love the fact that your quilt pieces, whatever they're called, I'm no quilter by any stretch. Nothing matches up. It's just what comes out of your mind. You don't care if your points match, I guess.
I actually care that they don't match, and if they do, I have to take it apart and fix it so they don't.
Okay.
Right? It's actually harder to create a beautiful composition where they don't match up. Because it is a challenge to get them not to match.
Yeah.
And to be beautiful.
Yeah, I suppose your mind wants everything to come together just neat and tidy. And
Well, and it just accidentally sometimes does, as you're sewing a couple, you've created a couple sections and they have a lot of seams in them, and then you sew those two sections together. Just by accident, sometimes some of those seams will match, because there's no pattern, there's no plan, and so then when they do match, it's like, darn it, I didn't want those to match. So I have to rip it all out and try again to make sure that these are spread, the spacing is different, so they don't create lines where I don't want lines to match, because it's much more pleasing to have them offset.
Yeah. Are you a fabric collector?
I am not a fabric collector. I used to be, back in my traditional quilt days. I had all sorts of fabric, but I don't do that anymore. I only use my own hand-dyed fabrics, and that's it. And I've gotten rid of all of my commercially purchased fabric. I sold it all.
That gives you the control you want, then.
Yeah, it gives me the colors I want, but it's about closing doors. It's about, like, I know this is what I want to do, and if I have all this other stuff, it has energy. So I had, you can imagine, like all quilters out there, I had a tremendous collection of commercially purchased cotton fabric from quilt stores.
Yeah, I've seen those stacks in some people's homes. Holy smokes.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I was never kind of over the top that much. When I see some of those photos, I'm like, well, I really didn't have that much, but I certainly had plenty. And I built a big home. I did a big remodel. I moved from the suburbs into the city of Denver, and I built a big studio on the back of that home. And when I did that move, I boxed up all of that commercial fabric with the thought of, well, if I don't use it for a few years, then maybe it's time to sell it. And so I boxed it up, and I hadn't used it in many years anyway. So I think after 4 or 5 years of living there and never using it, I thought, well, it should just go to someone that will use it. And so I basically put it for sale for the cost of shipping it to someone. I shoved it into those priority mailboxes, you know, those back when mail didn't cost a fortune.
Right.
You know, I think we're still sending those boxes for a few dollars, but by color, I sent it off to people, and it's gone. And now what that did is I don't have that fabric. Having this energy in my studio, pulling me to something that is in my past, not pushing me to my future. And those were not my future. They weren't going to get me where I wanted to go because they were not my own marks. I wanted those commercially printed cotton fabrics were somebody else's marks. Someone else made those lines. Someone else made those designs. And I wanted my own marks, my own lines, my own colors to be my artwork. I didn't want it to be somebody else's. So I kind of was like saying, I'm starting with a blank white canvas, and the things I'm adding to that are things that are the colors and the marks that I have created.
Yeah. So then you have to become a mad chemist and learn how to dye fabric?
Yep. Then I had to learn how to dye fabric, and I was kind of terrified about it because it always sounded like you had to do all this measuring, and it just sounded really painful. So I took a dye painting class with Ann Johnston, you know, the prepared, what her books, whatever her books are called. But she, the first thing she did in that class is she like mixed the pure colors, red, yellow, blue. And then she goes, oh, this yellow is always too bright. And she took some blue dye and dumped it into the yellow and said, there, that's better. And I'm like, I can do this. I can absolutely do this, where we're not like weighing things out. And I know there's a lot of value in knowing that you can reproduce colors and doing it that way, but that is so not what I'm interested in. I like working with fabric is a very dry process, right? We're not making a mess. Yes, there might be a mound of fabric or some thread on the floor, but it's not messy, this wet, messy thing. But dyeing fabrics is my opportunity to do the finger painting part of the whole process. So I make a big mess. I dye a lot of fabric all at once. I dye in 1 yard pieces, and I just dye as many colors as I can. I try and do about 80 yards of fabric over a weekend, and I'll do that a couple of times a year. So I have a lot of fabric to choose from. And so it's just fun. And it is this kind of mad scientist sort of thing. It's a real challenge here in New Zealand because one of the things that dye process needs is heat. And New Zealand is notoriously lacking in heat. So. You know, people don't confuse it with Australia. We do not have heat here.
So are you, sounds to me like you're not all that finicky about colors. You just get close. You're not,
I don't match colors at all, but I have a very good intuition as to what I will get. I've been doing this for so many, you know, 25 years of dyeing fabric. You have a pretty good idea of what's going to happen when you mix certain colors. And so I know what I'm going to end up with. And what I have are 3 racks of Alpha Shells stuffed full of my own hand-dyed fabric. So I pretty much have every color I need. And when I when I'm working, I don't ever want to feel precious about the materials. And that's why I believe in having as much fabric as possible dyed and ready to go, because then I don't feel like I shouldn't use up this lime green or this beautiful orange or this mauve pink that is just perfect that I seem to like to use in a lot of my pieces, because I'll run out. So I just have lots of it. And I'm a big fan of having lots. I have every thread color from three manufacturers, plus backups. I keep an inventory, so when I run out of colors, I reorder, so I never run out, because I don't want my art to get stuck by scarcity. I know the supplies I want, and I have plenty of those supplies.
Yeah. Do you have a base fabric that you use all the time?
I do. I use Robert Kaufman's PFD Pimatex fabric. And during the pandemic, they stopped making it.
Oh, no.
Which caused a lot of stress in the quilting world as this fabric disappeared. It's like you can't get it anymore. And I had a wholesale account with Robert Kaufman because I used a lot of this fabric. And to keep that account open, I would sell, large quantities. If someone wanted to buy 100 yards, I would, let them get the discount that I got as a wholesale account, and they would drop ship it to them. So I had several people that would purchase the fabric from me in that way. Well, I had to stop doing that because the fabric disappeared and couldn't get it. Now, in theory, it came back, and I haven't looked into this recently, but it came back, but with a lot of flaws. It was a failure. It didn't work. And so they recalled all that they had produced, and I just said, I'm out of this game. I don't want to deal with this anymore. So I don't know if they fixed the problems and they're still making that fabric, or I have no idea. It's been, about 6 to 8 months since I checked. So maybe they are, maybe they fixed their Pimatex problems. But here's my trick, is that when I moved to New Zealand, I put everything I own in a shipping container, and I put 1,000 yards of Robert Kaufman Pimatex fabric into that shipping container, ready to be dyed. So I'm good. I probably have one of the largest stashes of Pimatex PFD fabric of the old stuff back when they did a really good job making it.
Yeah, back in the day. Yeah.
Back in the day. It's probably, if they haven't fixed their problem and not making it again, it's probably worth a lot more money than it used to be. That's for sure. But I dye a little bit of it every year, and I figure I've gotten the fabric to last a lifetime.
Yeah. Oh, that pandemic. There are going to be stories for years to come of the impact it had on all aspects of life, manufacturing, art, all of it. Yeah.
Everything. Yeah. It changed so many things. Many things. Yeah.
And there you sit with your little treasure trove of
my Pimatex fabric. I'm assuming you can probably get it again, but I haven't bothered to look.
Yeah.
Well, now I'm curious. So I'll go look.
That's the thing, for them to come back and then have trouble. The magazine I edit is for manufacturing, and the personnel, the talent that walked out the door and didn't come back, and it's hard to replace that. And so you come back to start manufacturing something again, and it's just not right. Well, because the talent that was making it happen went out the door and didn't come back. And
well, and Robert Kaufman also they also make Kona cotton, and the Kona cotton solids are what they kind of put all their eggs in, the Kona cotton basket instead of the Pimatex basket. And so they had already dropped most of their colors of the Pimatex, but they kept black and white and the PFD for the Pimatex. But so they kind of already made that shift, and so that was partly the manufacturer's choice to kind of drop that line. And so that's why I think they just probably had such a pushback from everyone that uses the Pimatex. Like, oops, you cannot get rid of this. It, it is one of the fabrics of choice of Nancy Crowe's students. The people that have studied with Nancy Crowe, it is near the top of the choices. It takes dye really beautifully, and it's this super tightly woven fabric. It's hard to hand stitch through, but it's absolutely beautiful. to do piecing with, because as you're, if you're cutting it on the bias, it doesn't unravel. Mm-hmm. Like a looser weave fabric will, and it doesn't stretch as much. So it's just, it just behaves absolutely beautifully. And so once you get used to working with that really tightly woven fabric, you don't really want to start using something else.
Yeah, have to relearn all over, yeah.
Right, there's so much embodied knowledge in our fingers, right? I just intuitively know how to manipulate that fabric after using it for 25 years. I just can do it. I don't have to think about it. And if I were to switch it to a different fabric brand, it would be a very big learning curve.
Yeah. Now, your work is very abstract. I guess I just flat out say it is abstract.
Yep.
What is it about abstract that speaks to you? And so many forms of it. You really, you know, like you talk about working in series and then exploring every aspect of it. But what is it about abstract that works for you?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. You had that question for me to think about, like, why abstract? Why? What is it that speaks to me? And I think I just love beautiful design. And a lot of it, I think, goes back to growing up in New Mexico. And my notion of art was the Native American art of the Pueblo tribes. And there's a lot of pattern involved, a lot of color, a lot of pattern. And to me, that is beautiful. You know, thinking about the patterns on the pottery, thinking about, you know, all of the bead work, it's all abstract. It's not really a lot of realistic art. And I grew up in New Mexico, you know, and there was not a lot of other art. I was not surrounded by art. I didn't really pay attention to kind of Western art for till I was in my early 20s. I went, maybe late teens, went to New York City, and I went to the Guggenheim, and this would have been the early 80s, and there was an abstract expressionist show there at the Guggenheim, and walking down that spiral down the museum and seeing all that abstract art, I was just blown away. It was just absolutely incredible. And so I've always just been drawn to pattern, line, shape, color, and color. Love color.
That's the other part I wanted to explore with you is any formal training or does color just come to you?
Color just kind of comes to me.
Okay.
Like color. Now, I do know color theory, right? I do know color theory, but I just do it. You know, I do a lot of teaching. I don't teach people how to make art. I say I teach people how to be an artist, which is kind of a different thing. But the one class I will never teach is a color class. I'm like, I'm not going to teach that class because what I'm going to say is just, like, do it. It's just obvious to me. It's kind of like that tech thing, right? Today, people will say, how do you do this thing in tech? And I'll, like, rattle off, here's what you do. And to me, it's obvious. And it, like 90% of those words mean nothing to them. So I've learned that, you know, there's certain things that I know that other people maybe don't connect with. So to me, color is easy and obvious. And I can't, it's not something I want to define so I can teach it. And yeah. I could, you know, and, you know, I teach a design course, and that design course does include a module on color. And we basically just focus on the basic and obvious, and possibly that's all someone needs is, you know, what's a triadic color scheme, you know, try something in that, and you start seeing colors that you like. But it's about paying attention, just paying attention and putting together colors that you think are cool, even though maybe there's no rule that says that those should be cool.
Yeah, well, I'm envious. I struggle with color all the time. So,
oh, man, yes, I'm not the one to teach you how to do that well.
Yeah, and my wife is color for her is, you know, just kind of automatic, and I don't even understand how she sees it. I don't know, but it works. So,
yeah.
But for me, it's very mechanical and difficult. Yeah. And then I have male red green color blindness, which doesn't help. So,
oh, that absolutely probably does not help. I was going to ask you if you have color blindness, because that can really be a challenge.
Yeah, no, if you give me a Christmas red and a Christmas green, I'm good. You start getting into the shades, and I start getting in trouble in a hurry. And,
does it all just kind of go to brown or something?
Well, the purples go to blue, and the greens just, I have no idea what happens with greens, but there are some greens that, what was it? I had some skeins of thread that were all red, and I went to my wife, and I said, all right, which one of these goes with this? And she looked at him, she says, well, this one's green, so this doesn't go with any of them. It's like, how'd that get in there? You know, and then I hold it up in light and explore it, you know, and study it in the right, and oh yeah, I guess it is green. But, you know, it's a constant
battle. You know, so here's what I think about that. Like, my opinion about that is just, like, use what you think looks to get good based on what you see. And don't worry about what other people think. That's what I would recommend is, like, so what if other people think it's weird, right? Like, if these are all my reds and one of them happens to be green, cool, go for it. You know?
Yeah. Well, see, you know, that's all born out of a childhood trauma kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I've been told through my entire childhood that, no, that's the wrong color. And after a while, you quit trying. You just hide it.
You've heard this message your whole life. And it's like, well, where do you get the confidence to just go, I don't care, it looks good to me.
Yeah.
I'm making art for myself and not for you. So, what, you know, I think it looks really cool.
Yep. No, I tell the story. The first I learned red-green color blindness was freshman biology in high school. And we had the football coach as the teacher. And he's holding up those circles with all the dots, and people are yelling out the numbers that they see.
And right, yeah.
I'm not seeing numbers in a good number of the, a good, you know, several of them. So stupid me, I raised my hand. You know, this is freshman. Yeah, you're a high school freshman. And right. Stupid me, I raised my hand. I said, what numbers are you guys talking about? He hauls me up to the front of the class and takes me through the series to determine that I'm red-green colorblind in front of the class.
In front of the whole class.
The whole class.
Like there's a little trauma right there.
Right. So then I'm freak of the week, you know?
Yeah,
and,
right.
And, exactly. You know, what color is this? What color is this? And it was just, yeah, and you know, that, I mean, that's one of those childhood moments that it just is just burnt into you. And boy, after that, I shied away from colors before, but after that, you know, I really go out of my way to not name a color.
All right, so here this, you asked me, like, one of the things you're going to ask me about, like, towards the end of this is my teaching, because I'm also a life coach, right?
Yes.
So here, I will explain the difference between teaching and coaching using this as an example. Teaching is telling people things, right? Here's what I know, and I'm going to tell you, and you're going to learn something. Coaching is working with people one-on-one and saying, here's where you are today. Where are you stuck, and how do you move forward? So if I were to work with you as a coach, we would really talk about, like, your feelings about this. We wouldn't try and fix it. We wouldn't go to the past. We'd say, okay, here's where you're today. What are some tools you can do today to gain more confidence with color? To just, like, name them your own names. Like, maybe you get to come up with your own names for the colors and stop worrying about what the world thinks. And then just move forward from there. How do you move forward and with all that baggage that comes in our past? We therapists fix all that baggage. Coaches say, yeah, whatever, we all have it. Now what?
Yeah, move on. Okay.
Move on. And it's not teaching. It's about helping you find the tools for yourself, like having the conversations where I ask questions, you answer, you figure it out, and then you choose to take the actions that you come up with. So that's the difference between teaching and coaching. So that was a great way of answering with a good example there.
Yeah.
I want to teach you how to use color. I would coach you on how to just be confident with what you see, and that is all you need to worry about.
Okay. Okay, I can work on it from that perspective.
Yeah, yeah. Don't worry about what other people say about it.
But yeah, it goes all the way back. If Crayola didn't put the name of the color on the label, I would have never been right. I mean, it was right from the get go.
Right from the get go, yeah. It was a challenge for
you. Yeah.
And
didn't know, and teachers just didn't know. It's just, he can't do his colors. He doesn't know his colors. Oh, for crying out loud, I can't even tell, and.
Right, exactly.
Leave me alone.
Today, teachers, I think, are a little bit more aware of such things. And, hopefully they get to shame kids in other ways. That's the job of a teacher.
Yeah.
create trauma in some way.
That high school football coach, he did the job on me that day.
He definitely did. Yep. He carried this label with you that I don't know colors, and it's humiliating. Yep.
Well, yeah, the classroom where I was sitting, all of it is absolutely burned into my mind because I just wanted to disappear.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So, all right. So, enough of my problems. I was so fascinated by how you work series and the mental process. But then, there's the series thing, but then pushing beyond the obvious, that phrase that you had in there somewhere when you're teaching or wherever it was, pushing beyond the obvious, teaching your people, your students to do more.
People think working in a series, oh, that's just doing the same thing over and over again. And I'm like, and so artists go, I don't want to do that because how boring is that? And I think it's the opposite. I think working in a series is not doing the same thing over and over again. It's about finding out what you're interested in, closing those doors, kind of like me getting rid of all those commercial cottons and knowing I just wanted to work with my own colors. Close the doors on things that are going to be a distraction, like narrow it down to this box. And then what you end up doing, because we're such contrarians, even to our own rules, and we start pushing against the edges and we push ourselves, like we define this series we're going to work on, and we're going to push ourselves into new directions. And it's about allowing yourself to go deeper into the work by narrowing down what you're working on. I mean, the greatest example, right? I mean, if you're given a blank piece of paper and you're told, be creative in this space, it's like, ew, yikes, what does that even mean? How do I even start? But if you're given a piece of paper that says, draw a chicken that's blue, well, if we have the Crayolas marked blue for you, right, and make it creative, you can do that because you have some rules in which to start. And then if I said, now do it again, but you have to do it different, you could do that. But if every single time you go to the studio and you're like, now what am I going to make? And you have to come up with the rules, a whole new idea every single time, it's hard. It's really hard every single time to come up with a brand new idea, brand new thing. So working in a series is this way of clarifying where to start. It doesn't tell us where you're going to end up. It tells us where you're going to start.
But is it letting your mind relax, or is it keep pounding away and trying different things?
I think it's both. I think it's both. I think it's about being open to letting whatever happens to happen, but it's also sometimes hard work. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what making art is. It's just this push and pull. Art isn't easy. There's this phrase that, people don't love writing. They love the fact that they've written. And I think people do absolutely love making. And certainly for those of us that have a really strong craft side to our work, we love that craft side of it. I mean, I spent hours and hours and hours sewing straight lines back and forth in my sewing machine. And that isn't really stretching my creative artistic side so much as really soothing that part of me that loves the craft, the making part of it. So we have all these come together, but there's a hard part in there. That, like, creativity, what is this thing I want to make? It can be hard. It can be painful and hard. And there are, an untold number of artists that quit because it is hard, because they find the struggle too challenging.
When you do a series, is it kind of like a family tree where you have the obvious ones as the trunk, and then you go off in these branches of...
Oh my God, that's exactly how I view it. I mean, that's how I talk about a series tree when I'm teaching working in a series.
Oh, okay.
I talk about the series tree. You know, people think it's like this linear march forward in time, but it's absolutely not. It's absolutely, I see it as a tree of, okay, I march forward for a time, but that got boring. So I go back to this one way back that I started at the beginning, and I try going down a different path. So okay. I think you end up with this beautiful tree.
So, all right. So then if you have six original series pieces, then go back to number three, and what can I do with that off to a left turn and off I go.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. That's exactly it. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I did not read that in any of your stuff. I just kind of...
Yeah, it's all in my class. You know, like I said, half the stuff I say and do, it's all, you know.
Yeah. Now, you talk in there about mark making and how that changed your art.
Yes. So I was doing this improvisational piecing and cutting and piecing fabric and doing a lot of stitching on it. And I just felt it was time for something new, right? It had become so easy for me. You know, I wasn't facing any of that stress of what should I do next. And, you know, maybe the masochistic part of me wants that stress. I want art to be harder, but it's like I had unlocked, I'd figured it out. I did a series called Structures, and I made 200 pieces, and then I needed to move on. I mean, I did some other series in there along the way, but that kind of main series was sort of it flowed through my 15 years of my art career, and it was time to say, you know, that needs to shift and change. You need to do something different. So I did a 100-day project, one of these projects where you do something every day for 100 days, and I decided to make, to just explore mark making. And I knew I'd do it in black and white because color can be so seductive. You want to kind of remove color from the equation as you're trying out some other design ideas. So you're focused on those and not color. Mm-hmm. You can spend hours on color. So I bought a bunch of mark making tools, things that you can make marks on fabric with, paints and stamps and all sorts of things. But I very quickly settled into just one way of doing it, using textile paint to create pattern, more abstract pattern, going back to that New Mexico pattern lines, things in a row, seeing that. And I quickly did that, and I created these 100 small pieces in black and white. And then I did a series of black and white pieces. And one day I'm like, all right, it's time to jump into color. And I started using color with it. I still almost always use black and white paint. I've thought about mixing other paint colors to work with it, but I kind of haven't finished exploring using paint for that work. Most of it is stamped on. So I'm using hand carved stamps and rubber stamps, which goes back to taking a class with Natasha Kemper Collins back in the late 90s. I took a class with her to learn how to paint fabric, and I use ProFab textile paints from Pro Chemical and Dye. And so I learned how to do that with her. And so I kind of carried that forward, and I had done some work with that painted fabric kind of through the years, but this was kind of purposely making those marks. And I was painting the fabric and then cutting it up, but I quickly decided I would rather do all the piecing and cutting. So I'd make the entire quilt top, but I'd even baste and layer it, and then I would paint the marks on it. So it's like terrifying, right? you've spent all this time creating this quilt, and then now you're going to paint on it.
Yeah. Be careful.
Yeah, exactly. Be careful, or pretend like you really meant to do that.
Yeah. Well, that structure series, I had that was one where you owe me some time on that one.
All right.
Because it just intrigued me to see how you, what you started with, and then how you took that thing, and oh, the variations are just endless.
Yeah, I mean, and I could have kept going, right, for a long time. And I tell you, I have a piece blocked out on my wall that I'm like, structures, not structures, structures. Go back to it, because now I'm excited about it again. It's been 8 years since I've made the last piece in the structures series, and I'm like, it was really fun. I really love those thin lines. But it became, so the structure series is based on a photo of a fence in my dad's backyard, and you can think of it as a great big capital letter E, yeah. Essentially, is what it is. And it's that motif kind of stretched and pulled, and you don't see it in the end work so much. You wouldn't identify it as, oh, that's just the capital letter E in various ways, because it has changed so much over time. But there's so many things you can do with such a simple motif.
Yeah, well, that was just it. Basically, four sticks.
Yeah,
and then what you did with that is it just and yeah, and then I mean, you asked the question, knowing when to move on, when to stop, and that was what came to my mind looking at that was, how does she know when she's done them all, or do you get bored, or you just get tired?
Yeah, when you get bored, right? I mean, I look at, you know, some of the abstract expressionists, you can see that's what you're doing. If we look at de Kooning's work, that's exactly what he was doing. And if you read his the biography on his work, he worked in so many different styles. He had the big black and white, and then the color abstracts, and then he did the women's series, and he did some landscapes. And so he talks about, you know, as soon as he figured it out, right? Yeah. He was bored. He's got, like, I figured it out. And he'd make this, you know, kind of the masterpiece of the black and white work. And then he's like, okay, well, I've got it. I can do that. Why would I want to do that again? Right. That's like now using a pattern since mm-hmm. I have it figured out. And that's when I know it's time to move on, where it feels like I'm using a pattern. Although I'd say the number one thing my students do is they stop way too soon. They think that they can't push further, but they can. What if you, like, tried really hard? I'll never forget, like, one of the workshops I was in, one of our assignments, I remember it as we had to do 100, but we probably didn't do 100 drawings. But we did a whole bunch of drawings, barely 50, one a minute. We just sat there for an hour, did one drawing a minute of the exact same thing, just keep drawing it, keep drawing it, keep drawing it, keep drawing it. You know, some of mine were shopping lists because I was bored and I didn't quite get what we were doing. But it was amazing how you can force yourself to be creative in that way.
Yeah.
And I just did that. You know, we mentioned, I think, before we started recording about this wool shed that I went and spent a week at a wool shed and was very, very cold. But what I did during that time in the wool shed is I had this new motif I wanted to work with. And I did 100 watercolor paintings during that time because I didn't want to bring my sewing machine up there. So I did watercolor and I painted. So I painted these 100 watercolor paintings. And it was fun to see how they shifted across just a 1 week period.
Uh-huh.
You know, they started out with red, yellow, and blue, and by the end, I was using all the colors, you know. We were not sticking to red, yellow, and blue. And the circles had been split in half, and they were, it just morphs if you allow yourself to just keep pushing, you know.
Yeah.
Try something different. Make yourself move on, you know. So if you haven't made 100 of them, there's still more options out there.
Yep. No, that picture, that stack of them. And
all
at the desk with the oil heater providing the only heat you had. And
oh, I was so cold. It was so cold.
All right. Here we are. We've run out of time, but we're going to make some time here. So Make Big Art. Tell me. So Lisa Call is where your art is at.
Yes.
How does makebigart.com fit in? That's your teaching side.
That's my teaching side.
Sort that
side
for us.
So first off, the name of the teaching site being called Make Big Art, I was working with a coach. One of the reasons I became a life coach is that working with coaches has really helped me refine what I really want. But I thing. I said to her, I just really want to make big art. And she's like, well, that's what you call your teaching website. I'm like, okay. She said, you know, buy that URL because you don't know what you're going to do with it. So I bought the URL and then it kind of turned into my teaching website. But the reason I keep it separate from my art is I don't ever want to be just a teacher, right? Those that can do and those that can't teach, that's not going to, I was like, that's never going to be me. But I found that my blogging started to get taken over by marketing my classes and saying, I have these classes to offer. And I didn't want that. I wanted a place to still talk about my art. So I spent a lot of time separating the two. That's one of the first things I did when I got to New Zealand. It was, you know, so it was only 8 years ago that I created this full identity over on Make Big Art to keep all the teaching and coaching stuff in that location and keep my art just about my art. So I could say, this is what I'm doing. You know, gallery representation, I'm doing shows. I want to be able to send them to a place where they don't get inundated with a bunch of teaching information. So I put all the teaching and coaching over on this other website with a plan of, I'm going to blog over there all the time too, right? I mean, running two websites is really hard. So a couple years ago, I decided I was going to merge these two back together again because it didn't work. So, but I kept resisting and not doing it. So I came to the conclusion, I'm clearly not ever going to do this because I don't want to. I don't want to put all that marketing back onto my art website. So I will keep it separate. But what I did, and it's just kind of interesting how this came about. I used to teach my classes via email. I would just send out emails and then we would meet, not on Zoom because it was before Zoom kind of took off, something called AnyMeeting. But then we had this thing called the pandemic, and like kind of coincidentally at that same time, pre-pandemic, but like in late 2019, I had decided to switch all my teaching to this online teaching platform that also provided a community. So kind of like Facebook, but without Facebook. So it's just us. It's just us artists there. There's no advertising. There's no nothing. And so I started this community and we launched the community in January of 2020. It was like perfect timing for pandemic. So, you know, it's a small community. You know, we have small groups of people. I'm not interested in thousands of people. My classes are tiny. I teach to 6 to 8 people at a time. I'm not, this whole massive teaching thing is not interesting to me. I prefer to get to know my students. And even though it's online, we have a relationship. And so I moved to this site and now they're making it. So I think that kind of community will eventually become my Make Big Art website. I can drop the traditional website and it will all become the community will offer that. They keep promising this upgrade. It's been a year. I tease them all the time about it. They what year are you going to actually offer that? But it's such a great thing. And I know that through the pandemic, connection with community was really what kept us all going. Right?
Yeah.
And Zoom. Now I teach on Zoom and it's so much better. I no longer have to explain to people what it means to teach online. I'm like, just get on Zoom. And everyone goes, okay.
Yeah, that became part of the fabric of life in a hurry, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. It absolutely did.
No, and I know what you mean about small groups like that. Before I became a magazine editor, I was a science teacher, high school science. And I had an advanced biology class with 7 students in it.
Oh, how great was that?
Oh, I can't even tell you how great it was. Ram 2 lab tables together, pull up chairs, and we just sit around this big square and do biology. And because you connect. Yeah. You connect, and everybody exchanges because everybody feels part of the package. And there was nothing like it, you know. And the rest of the day would be 25, 30 students all in little rows at their desks, you know, or at the lab tables. And yeah, but no, that group of 7, and that was always the end of the day. So I ended my day with those 7 high-level students who cared about learning. And, yeah, we had so much fun. Yep.
Yeah, it's just, it's such a different experience. It, I mean, there, and like, because I'm not teaching people how to make art, I'm like never gonna, I don't want to do videos on how I make my art. I'm like, well, I did, you know, at the very beginning of my teaching, you know, long before Zoom, and it was easy to do this, I did do some videos on how I do my intentional piecing and my cutting and my piecing, but let someone else teach that. I'm not interested. I'm interested in the concepts of being an artist, like working in a series. And I teach a class that is fairly unusual for an online class called Finding Meaning in Your Art, Find Your Voice. And it talks about content. And most classes that are taught online are all about technique or doing a project or learning something about design, but not about content. But if you're going to go to art school, you're just going to learn about content, 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 right? Content is what it's all about. You know, what is the narrative of your work and what are you trying to say? And so I teach a class on understanding how you do that. What does that mean for artists that haven't gone to art school? How do you find that meaning? And there's all these different layers, and it, coming from an academic background, you know, I teach my classes with, you know, PowerPoint, and it's very academic, but we go through the academic sort of like, here's what meaning means in art and how you figure that out.
Yeah. Well, that was, you know, I had noted that class because I was looking through your various class titles there, you know, what one would I take? And that was the one that jumped out at
that
me.
Yeah.
Because yeah. It isn't just art, you know, finding your voice. It's, you know, to me, that can apply in many aspects of life. So I saw more value in that than just art.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, that all of my classes are kind of like that, where it's just really goes beyond just here's how to make something.
Yeah. All right. We're basically out of time here, but yep. Do some marketing. What's coming up? What can people participate in?
I think one of the keys in a lot of this is having a good sketchbook practice. It's just invaluable to have a sketchbook practice. So I run a sketchbook challenge every year, and we'll start in November, and it runs through January. And so that will be available. And then I'm going to, for the first time, do an intensive online version of working in a series that's coming up in December. And I will be getting my courses figured out, because this year I made the decision that I am not going to be teaching. I teach these year-long programs. I'm not going to teach the year-long program again. So this year was the end of Create a Body of Work. And I don't know what's next. So like, stay tuned, sign up for my mailing list and find out, because I'm going to figure out, all of my courses include some coaching sort of aspect to them, because you can't make art if you don't have your head sorted out.
Yeah.
It's like, we're whole, complete human beings, and we're kind of like, we can't silo the art if we don't away from the other aspects of our art. So there's lots of mindsets in my courses.
All right. So, all right, and all of that is at makebigart.com. So makebigart.com, and then lisacall.com is where we find Lisa's art.
Yes.
Yeah, and set aside some time when you go to that site, because I learned the hard way. It will, it'll chew up some it'll chew up some minutes in a hurry. It was so much fun. Yeah, I sound like I'm complaining, but I really enjoyed it. It was just, really captivating. So enjoyed it.
Fantastic.
Yeah. All right, Lisa, thanks so much.
You're most welcome.
All right, and thanks to everyone for listening.